Good afternoon. And this time with mic audio. Okay. So last time we talked about out of order and we had moving beyond our registry naming step. We need to actually execute instructions. And we need to figure out what instructions do we run. And kind of our key idea is that we have this queue or queues of ready instructions and we need to check, can they go yet? And our mechanism for doing that is we have this kind of array indicating which registers were ready. And a register can only be not ready or ready because we had this policy with registry naming that the register either stores one version of a value or isn't written yet. There's no second version, third version to worry about. Then we need to worry about, well, once we issue an instruction, how long is it going to take to compute its value? And we mentioned that, well, we're going to have kind of probably a variety of what we called execution units or functional units that actually run the instructions. And often they won't run the instruction in just one cycle like we saw with our five-stage processor where we had an execute stage and a memory stage and they always took the same amount of time. Often they'll have, some instructions will take multiple cycles, some instructions will take one, and often we'll have execution units that are pipeline, meaning that, it will take several cycles to do each computation or memory access, but we might be able to issue a new one every cycle. And sometimes you won't, they won't be pipeline, it depends on how they're implemented. And a really nice thing about the out-of-order design is that we can easily accommodate these kind of mixes of instructions where with just plain pipelining, we are kind of forced to make everything homogeneous. We have to waste that memory stage on every instruction just to keep things in sync. With out of order, we don't have to worry about that, and it's a lot less bad if some instructions take three cycles to compute and some take one. We still get most of the advantage of instructions taking one without doing much extra work. Then we talked a bit about branch prediction strategies. So we said that, there were these static predictions and kind of the best we could do without looking at what happened previously is this forward not taken, backward taken idea. And then we said, well, we can do better by looking at what happened recently. And kind of the basic idea is that we have some table. We look up in the table based on the instruction we're trying to execute. Kind of the simplest way is it's a hash table, and we hash the address of the instruction we're executing, and the table tells us what our prediction should be, and we update that when we figure out what it actually did. And if we're running an instruction over and over again, it usually does the same thing. This will tell us what to expect. So today we're going to go on to a new topic, which probably will be our last topic, which is on side channels. And we're going to kind of combine sort of a whole bunch of things we're learning this semester to talk about this topic. It's going to end up being a case we're going to talk about caches and virtual memory and exceptions, all get in here. But start out, we're going to look at side channels in a context which doesn't involve that sort of thing. It's just about kind of just instruction, execution, and timing. And the general concept of side channels, and we'll see some specific examples, is that we have a main channel from which our code gives us its output. So a function has a return value, or maybe a function returns its value by editing a pointer we pass in, or editing what a pointer points to that we pass in. Something like that. There's the intended way for us to get information out of a function or some other thing or a program. A side channel is an unintended way in which a function or program or machine or some process leaks information. So it's some extra communication channel that wasn't intended. And an example that we're going to see in the lab next week is naive password checking. So here I have a function that checks a passphrase, and it checks a passphrase by comparing it character by character with a reference. And kind of what we think of this function is that if I can call this function lots of times, all I'm conceptually learning is, do my guesses match the password? That's the main channel of information out of this function. But this function has a side channel in practice, because when we run the function, we can also figure out how long does it take to run. That's not something the function's going to output directly for us, but it's easy to call the function and collect that additional information. And how long the function takes to run, well, it's going to vary, especially because, right, there's these instructions here, like this accesses the cache, and this accesses the cache, and that's going to take different amounts of time at different points in time. We have out-of-order execution, like making all sorts of ways our timings are going to vary based on random things going on in the machine. But in general, if it takes longer to run, probably that means the loop ran more. So how long this function runs gives us a hint whether the loop ran more or less times. So something we can do, and something you're going to do in the lab next week, is we can just run this function a bunch of times with a bunch of different guesses. And some of them are going to stand out. They're going to just take a little longer because that loop runs some extra times. And probably our data is going to be noisy, but if we run this enough, we'll get a good enough measurement that we can figure out, in this case, when we guess something starting with D, it takes a little longer. Probably the reason it takes a little longer is that this loop runs two times instead of one time. And I can keep going. I could say, okay, so if the first thing is D, I can repeat this strategy by saying, well, if it probably starts with a D, let's try guessing the next character, and that should take a little bit longer than the other ones. And so even though this function only outputs is the password right or wrong, because of how it's implemented, if we're given a tool to just run this function and tell me what it does, we can use that with this timing information to figure out what the passphrase is a lot better than what the return value tells us. And in practice, if you are doing this type of checking for security purposes, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to not write a loop with a variable number of iterations. Quite seriously. That's a thing you will actually need to worry about. So that's one context in which this comes up. And there's other contexts in which these timing things come up. And sometimes there's not an obvious loop. And so, as an example, I'm going to talk about a bunch of things in cryptography. And that's because kind of the cryptographic implementation community discovered these security issues first, because they are very bad for encryption and similar signature and so on algorithms. So it's really bad because we depend on not being able to guess a secret key or a private key. And even if we get part of it, that kind of breaks things. In particular, where this has been a problem very early was asymmetric cryptography. So a lot of asymmetric cryptography, for reasons that you can learn if you take number theory classes or learn about RSA, uses big integer math. So for example, an operation they might want to do is multiplying two big 500-bit digit numbers together. And that's just one multiply, but let's think about how that's implemented. And to talk about how do we implement multiplying two 500-bit numbers together, I'm going to start with a simpler example. Let's multiply two 64-bit numbers together to get a 128-bit result. I can't just do that with a multiply, with a normal multiply instruction that produces a 64-bit result. So let's say that's all I have, and I want to implement this 64 times 64-bit number gives me 128 bits. One way I can do that is I can say, okay, I'm going to take my integer x, and I'm going to write it as a sum of its upper bits times 2 to the 32 and its lower bits. I'm going to do the same for y. Then I just do some algebra and say, well, x times y is equal to x1 times 2 to the 32 plus x0 times plus similar for y. Y1 times 2 to the 32 plus y0. And we just apply good old algebra FOIL, first inside, outside, left. And we get this formula that only involves 32-bit multiplies, producing a 64-bit result. And we just need to manage, you know, storing the different parts of the number separately. And this kind of strategy is how, well, is the simplest way of implementing big integer multiplies. That we kind of turn it into this algebra problem, we do the different terms separately, and then we have to deal with like figuring out, you know, shifting over our results to handle the 2 to the 32 and 2 to the 64 part, well, which is obviously important, but for our purposes, mostly an implementation thing. So this is a way we can do big integer multiplication. And it's the most logical way, the simplest way to do it. There's some faster algorithms. But kind of something which comes up here is that the size of this formula depended on how many pieces I need to divide x and y into. So when we generalize this algorithm or similar multiplication algorithms, the number of steps in our multiply is going to depend on the size of the numbers we're multiplying. And cryptographic algorithms have this problem that, well, sometimes the size of the number we're multiplying, we have to keep secret. Because maybe it's like part of the private key. And oops, we accidentally reveal this through timing. Because it's going to drastically change how fast the multiply is if that number gets larger or smaller. And this one, in fact, was a problem in early versions of OpenSSL implementation of TLS. They had this timing attack, and the reason they had this is that kind of internally within the implementation of one of their of asymmetric decryption, they took the ciphertext mod secret, basically, did something like something similar to ciphertext mod secret, mod a secret value that you're not supposed to know. And the problem is, if that becomes small, that tells you your ciphertext value is close to the secret value. And if it's not small, it tells you it's far away. So this like gave you a way of figuring out how close is my ciphertext value to the secret value, and we could just give bogus ciphertext values. We don't care if they decrypt properly. As an attacker, we'll just send stuff that won't decrypt right. All we care about is how long it takes to not decrypt properly. So this ended up being a, at least looked like an attack you could run remotely. Like the timing signal was strong enough that you could look at how long it took you from across the internet to get a response, and you'd learn something about the secret value here. And if you learn enough about those secret values, you could brute force the private key. You wouldn't probably learn all the bits of it, but just like with our check passphrase example, right, we've made a lot of progress here, even though I haven't like decoded the whole passphrase. You know, if I have to try all the possible logical passphrases, by knowing the first two characters, I've saved myself a ton of time. And the same is going to be true in these kind of cryptographic algorithms, that even if I don't figure out the exact value of secret, if I know it's in a small range, that saves me a ton of time as an attacker. And gets rid of the assumption we have when choosing these secret values that It was big enough that it couldn't be guessed. And so this is a graph from that paper showing that when the enough bit, the bits matched, you have this big difference in the timing that they saw in their example. Okay, so I saw a bunch of attacks which are based on this time difference, you know, where we change some value and that correlation to some secret has a time difference. We can use that to learn some secret value that isn't a real output of the function. Like the encryption function doesn't tell us, oh, by the way, the first 20 bits of the private value are this. It just tells us it didn't decrypt properly, sorry. But we have this side channel. But so far it's just been timing. There's other types of side channels. And a lot of these come up in kind of the browser context. The browser context actually is a big problem for these types of attacks because browsers for a long time have ran code that was given to you from an untrusted web page on your machine. And that code can do a lot of things like timing things or checking things. And the browser is supposed to keep that code from doing things it's not supposed to do. And one of the things that code shouldn't be able to do is know what other websites you visit. You shouldn't be able to go to facebook.com and have Facebook know your whole browser history. Like, that's something we'd like to avoid. Or you shouldn't definitely not be able to go to, like, and maybe even a much less trustworthy website and have it do that. But there was a case where there wasn't a timing issue, but there was a set of browser features that sort of accidentally let websites figure out what web pages you visited in the past. And there's these two convenient features where you can understand why both of them were implemented and both of them were thought to be good ideas. So one feature is one that's been around for a very long time, which is that if you visited a link before, we like highlighting it to remind you that, oh, you visited that link before, so you know. It's been a feature in browsers since the 90s. So you can see, you know, which links are visited. Another feature is when we started having scripting in web pages, you know, the web page wants to manipulate the appearance of things. And as part of doing that, it's really good to check, you know, what does this actually look like now? So like I can change the color to make it darker or something like that. You know, that's a functionality that seems pretty useful to provide. But when we combine these two, we can say, let's look at the link for foo.com, let's find that link and see what color it is. Is it the visited color or the unvisited color? And if you wanted to kind of weaponize this, you'd have your normal web page, and at the bottom of it, where no one ever scrolls, you have a million links to a million candidate website URLs, and you have a script that checks all of them for their colors. And sends back the results to your server, you know, maybe with like a form, like with your login form or something. So this is obviously unacceptable, and you can see that this arose not because of any sort of real clever timing or anything. It's just kind of these two features made sense apart, but together they're pretty bad. Now, this isn't possible anymore, and the fix for it, like, is kind of, you know, bizarre in the sense that if you think about this, like, you think about, gosh, implementing browsers securely is really hard. The fix is they got rid of convenient feature 2. But they didn't fully get rid of it because it's still convenient. So what they did is they made it so getComputedStyle, that function to tell you what color things are, among other things, will lie about the color of visited links. Just tells you the wrong answer. And also, it turned out that you could style visited links to like be bigger and things like that. They had to get rid of that option because otherwise you could like infer whether a link was visited by like making it really big and making it hide something else on the page. So they've made it so there's a very limited set of things you can change on visited versus unvisited links that don't like affect how things are laid out on the page and other things you might be able to tell indirectly. But gosh, this is an annoying thing to think about in what should be a part of the browser you don't care about security stuff in, other than don't let it crash. So a more modern example of a web page leakage comes from a more recent academic paper. And their observation was, well, we can run a script in a web page that like just times doing something. And the thing we're going to time doing is just reading and writing from a big array. And the idea is, well, that's going to depend on what's going on with the caches and other things on the machine, like whether you get context switch in and out. Like that's going to vary based on sort of all sorts of things going on in the machine. And they did this, and they observed if you had another web page open in another tab that was doing a lot of stuff, well, it kind of created this signature in those timings with all its cache accesses and context switches and whatever it's doing. And you could make an educated guess just from your timings about what was going on in that other tab. Because we're sharing caches, we're sharing processors. And there are these shared resources that make your array accesses slower because we have to switch to, you know, the New York Times tab and run some code for a little bit to display something for a little bit at the right amount of time. So this is kind of, seems like, this seems harder to fix, like, and this is not something where I say web browsers have a great fix. I think web browsers do is that it's actually really hard to get a high precision timer in a web browser, and this is part of why. But like this seems is really annoying, hard to fix. This kind of information. So that's about side channels generally. So next we're going to look at sort of building up to a particular type of side channel known as the Spectre attack, which kind of brought this to the forefront and has been having a big impact on how processor designers think about designing processors, because it showed that a lot of the cache and out of order stuff we were doing kind of gets us in trouble. So to build up to that, we're going to talk about inferring things through a side channel, which is not going to be based on just how long something takes, but based on how long it takes to access the cache. So in particular, let's say I time accessing an array of characters. An array of 0 takes 3 cycles. Array of 64 takes 4 cycles. Array of 128 takes 4 cycles. Array of 192 takes 20 cycles. Array of 256 takes 4 cycles. And everything else takes around 4 cycles. Well, what this tells me is something's different about array of 192, and the most likely cause is that was a cache miss. And this is a side channel that, well, you know, there's not a way to tell us, is this value in the cache? That's not an assembly instruction we have. There's no is in cache assembly instruction. But we can figure out if something's in the cache by timing. And more usefully, we can figure out where something else accessed the cache by seeing what it evicted. Because most cache accesses, once the cache gets full, evict something. We can see what it evicted by seeing if the thing it evicted is still in the cache when it was earlier. So we can use this to infer accesses to the cache. So as an example here, let's say I have my array here that's as big as the cache. And first, I access the entire array. The way our cache works, that's going to bring the entire array into the cache, because the cache, you know, wants to keep recently accessed values. Then I access some other address. And then what's going to happen is one of those values in that array is not going to be in the cache anymore, because the cache can only hold exactly that many things. So one of them at least had to be thrown out. And let's say that's array of 128. Well, probably that means that other address was, when it was accessed, evicted array of 128. So given that, what do we know about other addresses? You a minute to think about this. Okay, so who thinks A? They have the same tag. Who thinks B? They have the same index. Okay. Who thinks C? They have the same offset. Okay. Who thinks D? They have a different tag. I see most people say the same index, so you won't ask that. Who thinks F? They have a different offset. Okay, so most people said they have the same index. So if we remember how our cache works, right, we take the address, we take the index, we use that to get a row of the cache, we compare a tag we get there with the value we get from that row, and then we use the offset to access a particular bit of that, a particular byte or bytes of that block. So the same index means, well, it had to go to the same row because we only evict things from that row. You know, other things that have the same index, that's the only thing that uses that row, right? That's how our cache works. Index says what row we use has to be the same. It also has to have a different tag. That's a little less obvious, but if it has the same tag and the same index, then it must be part of the array. It must be the same block. And in that case, there would be no eviction. We just keep that block in the cache. So it has to also be a different tag. So questions here? Yes. What are we inferring? So we can figure out what other address must be. We know something about other address now. So it's in this example, it's in our code. Yeah, so it seems like this is a pointless little exercise, right? We're reading the value of other address in the most convoluted way possible. So the preview is that the future version of this will be doing, instead of having this access here, we'll be making a system call or something like that, and the system call will access other address. We can't read that out. But that's what we're building up to, is that we can use the same strategy to read things we're not supposed to be able to read. But yes, right now, yeah, it would be more straightforward to just look at other address. But yeah, we can apply the same technique for things we're not allowed to look at. And we will do that. So question, other questions? But yeah, good question. Yes, we're like, why are we bothering to guess the bits of other address? Okay, so there's some assumptions I made here that actually get us in trouble. So one is that most of our caches use physical and not virtual addresses, but our accesses actually use virtual addresses. And that kind of gets in trouble for how do I make sure the entire array is in the cache, that we don't have conflict misses keeping it from being stored same time? How do we use the values we get for other address, make that useful. This is indeed a problem. And it's annoying to deal with, but when people have done these attacks for real, they've dealt with it. So one thing is that you can kind of infer the addresses in other ways. Sometimes the OS will tell you what it is, or if not, you can use other measurements to, make an educated guess and kind of confirm that guess about what the addresses are. And more easily, the OS typically allocates addresses in order, and there's performance reasons why the OS might want to allocate big contiguous blocks of addresses. So often the addresses will be all together, which is the biggest problem we have with virtual memory messing this up. Another issue is that when we time these accesses, I'm kind of assuming time accessing array is timing accessing the array without evicting anything else from the cache. But probably we can't write a timing function that never uses the cache. Right? We're going to have something in memory it needs to access that's going to mess up the cache and mess up those measurements. So what we'll typically end up doing in practice is we'll like time with and without the operation of interest and see what the difference is to actually know what our timing looks like. Another issue is that the processor prefetching, you know, which is basically an idea where if you access array of 0, array of 16, array of 32, the processor will guess, oh, you want to go to array of 48 next and array of 92. The processor will like look ahead and try to guess what accesses you do. This can mess up our measurements. Make it hard to actually time the access you want because the processor will say, oh, you're about to do that access, let me do it for you. So we might need to like do some non-obvious work to actually time the cache accesses to see if it's evicted properly, to make sure the processor doesn't get clever and say, oh, I'm going to access that before you try, to so you don't notice it was evicted. Like, we don't want that, but there's ways of avoiding that. And there's other complications that happen. So for example, we talked about like the index bits being part of the address. In some processors, that's not how the L3 cache works. It actually uses like a hash function. But we can deal with these issues. It just is going to take some effort. So let's do an example here. So let's say I want to figure out whether mystery is true, or, you know, and whether basically does this happen. I want to figure out if this happens. So what I can look for is, well, whether that happens or not will affect what's in the cache. That either we'll evict something from the cache, from that access, or it won't happen, and we won't. So what array index should I check if this is my value for pointer to figure out if that happens? And the thing that's going to help me here is my assumption here is that this allocate aligned physical memory is going to set things up so array 0 is some tag index 0 offset 0 in the cache. And that means with 64-byte blocks, array of 63 is some tag index 0 offset 63, array of 64 is some tag index 1 offset 0, 128 is index 2, and basically 64 times n is index n. So that's something I'm going to use here. Questions? Set up here. So I want to figure out if the access to pointer happened. So pointer, if we do the plus equals one operation, we're going to access memory at that location, which involves putting it in the cache. So if we put it in the cache, well, we need to think about what index are we putting it in. And we're going to evict one of the things in the array from that index. And so if I look at this, well, my address here has these index bits, because my cache has 6 offset bits, 9 index bits. So we're going to access index, this is 6. So index 6 offsets something. And we just need to choose a value in the array that goes to the same index. Doesn't matter what offset it is, but it goes to the same index. And you know, I can do that by saying, okay, I'm going to go to 64 times 6, which is exactly what this is another way of writing. I'm going to go 6 blocks into the array, since block 0 is the beginning of index 0. If I go ahead 6 blocks, I'm in index 6. Some questions about my reasoning here. Okay, so we might say that, okay, this here, it seems like that entering this if statement, if we set this up correctly and set the threshold to the right value, that means that mystery is true. That seems like what's going on, but that's not actually the case. What this detects is if the pointer is accessed. It doesn't detect if mystery is true because of branch prediction. So branch prediction might mean that we start running that load. We're obviously going to throw away the result, but we start running it and then discard it because we mispredict the if statement. And right now, that seems like this makes this a lot less useful. We're going to find out later that this makes this attack a lot more useful. That this is not a problem, this is an opportunity that's going to create a giant headache for hardware manufacturers and OS writers. The fact that it doesn't actually matter whether mystery is true or not. So we have like detecting if another access happens. So we've done that. Another thing we can do that might be more relevant to detecting, in this case, the value of mystery, is we can figure out where another access happens. So rather than just checking one place, I'm going to check all the possible places and see which one matches. So let's say in this example that I detect that I access other array at index mystery, and I find out that array of 0x800 hex rather was slower to access. So that was evicted by accessing other array at mystery. So we know that this has the same index, same cache index, as other array of mystery. And using this, I can limit the possibilities for mystery. So kind of the simple analysis you might say is, well, if other array is at this address, then this is 0x200 is index 0, offset 0. And if we have our 64-byte block, let's assume the same cache, 32K-byte direct map cache, then, you know, we're going to say that 0x2400 is index 0x400 over 64, offset 0. You know, and then that would be, we want to get to index of 0x800 divided by 64, offset 0. Right. It needs to be in the same index. A way I can think about this more systematically is if I look at my offset, since I know I started index 0, that offset indicates where cache index 0x20. And I can fill that in and say, well, when I take my array base, plus the offset in the array, I need to have that same cache index. And I know the array base address is our 0x2400. And I can solve for the bits of x. And I don't actually know the exact index of mystery. I only know some of the bits. In particular, I only know the index bits. But that's OK. That's still a lot of information. So that's going to help me actually infer. What goes on there. So I can just solve this and figure out what the value of mystery is. I can also do, do this with a two-way cache. So with a two-way cache, I just have to be concerned that there's two values I could evict, and I just need to check both of them. So what's going to happen is that the, what array it is we should check, it should be sort of index 1 is going to be 180, like the direct map case, and index 2 is going to be 180 plus sort of the cache size divided by 2, like the other part of that array that maps to the same index, right? Because the indices wrap around. That's going to be how that works. So we'll just have to check multiple, but that's perfectly feasible for our multi-way caches, which is going to be the reality if we're doing this on a real processor, because very few processors have a direct map cache these days. So we've seen this pattern, and this pattern has a name in the literature called prime plus probe. And it's called that because we have this prime step, we fill the cache with a known array, and this probe step where we figure out where in that array has been evicted. And the purpose of this is to find out between the prime and probe steps what actually was accessed in the cache. So we get this kind of list of what values were accessed in the cache. And this attack was coined, so this idea was coined in attacks on AES encryption. So AES is a symmetric encryption primitive, something used to implement symmetric encryption. And early implementations of AES used a lookup table. It was, AES has some weird thing that you can compute with bit fiddling, but it's faster to pre-compute it and use a lookup table. So the implementations did this, and where you looked up in that table depended on the key, and also depended on the data being encrypted. In particular, it depended on like the XOR of the key and the data being encrypted. But what they could do with this is they could detect part of the index into the lookup table. They didn't get the full index, but they got a lot of it. And because they could vary the data being encrypted, they could kind of infer the exact value, and they could look for a pattern. So this is a picture from their paper. And basically, they had triggered a lot of encryptions, and they looked at what parts of the cache seem to be evicted more frequently. They took lots of measurements, and the darkness is the how often that was evicted or not evicted. And what they noticed is that if you kind of, so here's the raw measurements, and there's a lot of noise going on there. There's something going on, but it's basically the code accesses things that are at particular indices versus not. That's not useful, because they were varying what the data was as they went through here. But what they noticed is that if you subtract out the average here, average value of each row, you get this signal here where you can see what changes when you vary the data input. And you can see there's this clear signal indicating where we are in a lookup table that changes when we change that data. And it turns out where we are in that lookup table also is basically the data plus the key bit that we're not supposed to know. And we can figure out exactly where in the table we are by where that is. And we can get bits of the key. And so if we're running AES on the same machine that someone can run this attack on, like for example, if we're like doing local disk encryption, like you could use this to read out the key you're not supposed to have access to. So that's kind of the prime principle idea. So let's go back to this pattern here. So it seems like we have this big problem that, this is useful, but we're not getting like that much information. We're learning some of the bits of the value, but not probably the interesting parts. So let's make this better. So let's say I run this code, and I've done this nice trick that's going to make things really convenient of multiplying mystery by the block size. So if I think of my access to other array, it's going to be a 0x1000 plus mystery times the block size. And that means that since this is in index 0, this is going to be in set index mystery mod the number of sets, right? Because if mystery is 1, we're going to go from set 0 to set 1. If mystery is 2, we advance by 2 blocks, we go to set 2. If mystery is like the number of sets we have in total, we kind of wrap around. So remember that from when we were talking about C coding cache. And so this means that we're going to get 0x400, whatever set that is, 0x400 divided by the block size is equal to mystery divided by the block size. And so if our block size is, for example, 0x40, then this would be 0x10 mod the number of sets. And we'd have possibilities, which were 0x10 or 0x10 plus the number of sets, 0x10 plus 2 times the number of sets, and so on. So it's 0x400 divided by block size plus k times the sort of number of sets for some k we don't know. So let's go back to going back to this problem. So we have this neat idea that if we multiply the value by the block size, then we can actually get all the bits of mystery, not just kind of the middle, or at least all the lower bits, which is probably the more interesting part. And we have this pattern here where I said, oh, if mystery is false, well, we can have the case that, because of the misprediction, we actually run the pointer access in a bit gate. And we can do better than that. That if we want that access to happen, we can encourage the branch prediction to assume that branch is taken. So one example of how we could do this is that if I have foo that does x if x access pointer, I can, first I can call foo with a true value a lot of times, then I can call foo with a false value, And the way our branch predictor works, it's probably going to say, oh, usually when foo is called, we go into that if statement, because I did it a bunch. And I can kind of encourage it to do this access to the pointer, even though the code is not actually reachable. And we can combine that with our earlier trick. That if mystery times block size is equal to I, plus or minus, you know, the number of sets, you know, times k, you know, we'll tell if that's true. So you can read out the value of mystery through this access that never happens. Like, it doesn't really never happen, but it starts because of a branch misprediction and gets canceled. But the problem is it only gets partially canceled, right? We undo the modification to other array and all that stuff, but we get far enough to read other array from the cache and evict something else. So we can detect this code that never runs, and we can read the value it has. But right now, this seems like kind of a toy, right? Because, you know, if I want the value of mystery in this example, I can just read it. It's a variable. So we're going to do better here. And we're going to show our first example of, you know, like taking advantage of this. Let's say I trigger a seg fault and then access an invalid pointer. Oh, sorry, act as a pointer. Could that still happen? Yeah, because that's how out of order execution works, right? We're going to run the instructions that are available. So even though I have this trigger seg fault operation, we can skip past that and actually see what happens with this pointer. So we can use this idea to infer what happens in code, which is impossible to actually run for real, but it's going to run, you know, it's going to run enough that we can find out something about how it ran. And a thing that was true about Intel processors at the time this was discovered was that the Intel processor implemented memory accesses in this kind of two-step process. They had one step to check if the memory access did a seg fault, and another step to actually do it. And these were separate and could execute speculatively, like out of order from each other. They were basically treated like separate out of order operations in the processor. So the translate virtual to physical and the check the permission bits operations were separate operations in the processor, so we could have the processor actually do it. And so there was an attack called meltdown, which has this form. We do our prime operation, then we access a value that is impossible to access that will trigger a seg fault. But the way the seg fault works is the seg fault is kind of a separate operation, that the way the access is implemented in the Intel hardware of the time is that we do the access and check whether the access is allowed, and those kind of happen in parallel with each other. And sometimes we'll actually complete the cache access and evict something from the cache based on the value. So here, this is our mystery. And in this case, this is a mystery value we can't actually read, right? Because it never, you know, exists in the real code path. It's computed, but it's always thrown away before we can read it because there's a seg fault. But it turns out that it gets computed and it modifies the cache. So even though there's a seg fault, we can still see how it modified the cache. And we can do better, and we can have this code not really execute, so we can actually suppress the seg fault. like the processor will start executing this code, Clever branch misprediction potentially, and then that's fine. You know, we're gonna go far enough ahead to actually do the access, and we're gonna multiply it so we can read from the index bits the actual value directly, and we'll get our result. And so this attack was called Meltdown. This is the actual code, the assembly code the authors used. And it was a little simpler for what they did. So what they're doing is that they set RAX to zero, and they load into RAX memory 1 byte of values from an address that's part of the kernel that the page table say you can't access, except if you're in kernel mode. And we're not in kernel mode. So this segfaults. But on the processors of the time, when it segfaulted, it managed to sometimes run these next few instructions. We would shift over the value to multiply it by 4096 to make sure that the index bits told us which value it was exactly. You know, because otherwise we'd only learn the middle bits, so we made sure the middle bits were the value we wanted to know. And then we access an array, read from an array to evict something from the cache. And even though the segfaulted, before the segfault was detected, the processor would do that cache access. So they spaced out the accesses. Also, they were using 4096, which was larger than the cache block size, because this avoided triggering prefetching and other cache optimizations that would get in the way of their measurement. And they had this repeat access of zero because it turned out that sometimes internally the processor would guess the value was zero and start executing this, so they just avoided that by having it retried when it was zero. And this actually caused a segfault in their code. They didn't actually even use the if something false technique. And they just said, okay, just keep starting new processes, no problem. You know, run the process, have it segfault, check the cache. Run the process, have it segfault, check the cache. And eventually it will work. The cache will evict the thing that tells you what the value is, and you just redo this repeatedly for each byte of memory you want to read. So this is bad. And what may seem silly is, why is the permission check not sort of coupled with the virtual to physical translation? Like, why wasn't that the case? And that's a question I don't have an answer to, but ARM and AMD were doing that. Intel wasn't. Who knows? So the fix, obviously, is to do that in the hardware. But of course, in software, we need to work around this problem. So the workaround was to have a separate page table when running in kernel mode than in user mode, basically saying we can't use the protection bits, the permission bits in the page tables, they don't work anymore, so we'll have a separate page table in each mode to actually protect reading of the kernel memory. This is, you know, this works, but this has an unfortunate performance impact when you don't have the hardware fix, because changing page tables has a big cost, especially if you have to flush the TLB, which for some of the earlier processors you did. So later ones, there was ways of avoiding that. Okay, so let's look at go to our bigger problem. So Meltdown, it was bad. It was a big problem in pretty much all the Intel processors, but it has a straightforward hardware solution. At the same time that Meltdown was discovered, we also discovered, as a community, Spectre, which is a much harder to fix problem. And I'm gonna talk about the Spectre vulnerability, and I'm gonna show you some really contrived code. And either at the end of this lecture or next time, I'll tell you why this isn't as contrived as it looks. But right now, this code looks really contrived. I've designed this code to let me exploit it, it looks like. We'll learn later that this pattern actually appears everywhere, and it's going to get us in trouble in real code that wasn't deliberately written to be exploited. But it looks like this code is written to be exploited. So what do I have? I have an array bounce check, and this is going to be something where the problem is that this gets mispredicted, that sometimes, even though x is greater than array one size, we'll actually run the access of array one of x and go out of bounds. And then we'll take the value of array one of x, multiply it by a big value, and access array two, and that will leak the lower bits of array one of x. Like, we have the same, this is the gadget, you know, the little trick we use to read memory with the meltdown exploit. We're just reproducing that, but, you know, with not reading something that's, you know, from a seg fault. This is just from, you know, an array out of bounds access that doesn't really happen. But it's going to get run far enough to affect the cache. So let's say we're exploiting this. Well, if I can choose x here, we're going to assume our attacker can choose x. Well, we're going to choose x, if this is an array of cares, to be the thing we want to access minus the base of the array because of how array accesses work. So we can choose an x that accesses any memory location, provided that we ignore that bounce check, which we'll do because it will be mispredicted. We'll make sure it gets mispredicted. Okay. So let's say I've done that choice of x. And let's say I learn that this access evicted from cache set 128. And I have 64 blocks in my cache. What do I know about x? So I know array 2 starts at cache set 0. So array 2 of q is going to be cache set q divided by 64 mod 8192. And I know that equals, you know, so that's, you know, what we get. And I know this equals 128. And I know, so I want to find the possible values of q. And what I'm going to find out, and I know q is actually going to be my sort of secret here, which is going to be secret times 4096. So divided by 64 mod 8192 equals 128. So I have that formula here. Or I can say that secret times, this is 2 to the 4096 is 2 to the 12. 64 is 2 to the 6. Secret times 2 to the 6th mod 8192 is 2 to the 13 equals 128. So we have that secret times 2 to the 6th is equal to 128. Okay, secret is equal to 128 divided by 2 to the 6, which is equal to 2, or is equal to 8192 plus 128 divided by 2 to the 6, which is equal to 130, or so on. Here, so, or is equal to 8192 times 2 plus 128 divided by 2 to the 6, which is going to be 130 plus 128. And then we also have 130 plus 256, and so on. So we have a bunch of possible values. We actually have an extra constraint here that we know that this value is between 0 and 255 because it's an unsigned care. So our only possibilities are 2 or 130. Questions on how I got that answer? So you see, I just said, okay, I know I got this particular value. Let's look at our set. I know what form my x times 4096 had to equal one of these small number of possibilities, you know, that were just spaced by the cache size, basically, cache size divided by the number of ways, you know, number of sets apart. And I did just figure out, okay, it's 2 or 130. So questions? So let's combine all of these and let's talk about an actual, like what the actual kind of attack is going to be. So we're going to have something in the kernel where, remember, we can read memory we're not supposed to be able to read in user space, that's going to have our vulnerable code pattern, the one that looks really contrived right now. I promise I will make that less contrived in the future. We have that vulnerable code there. And what we're going to do is, first, we're going to run this code a whole bunch of times to make sure the branch predictor knows, hey, that if statement's always true, always passes. Like, the bounce check is always true. So we're going to do that a bunch of times to make sure that it's predicted as, yes, we're good. Then, once we're ready, we've done that, we're going to fill up the cache to measure things, and we're going to target the actual, you know, do the out-of-bounds access. We're going to make sure that this evaluates to the target address. And then I just do this computation where I say, you figure out what set got evicted, we subtract it from the set at the beginning of the array, and I divide by the number of sets for 4,096 bytes, and that gets me the first possible value. There might be some other values. We can compute them by adding based on the cache size. So I do my computation that we showed earlier, you know, where I say the set we evicted minus the starting set divided by our sets per k. That's the first possibility. There might be some others that are spaced based on the number of sets in the cache apart, but that gets us the value at that address that we chose, and we can run this over and over again to read off, you know, any memory byte by byte. So questions? This idea. So this idea is the Spectre attack, but this seems like it's not really a problem, because who writes code like that? You know, we don't just write functions that do these two array lookups and multiply one of the things by the other. Like, right, that's not a real thing, probably. But there's a reason why this is actually a problem in practice. So one reason is that the most contrived part here is this times 4096, right? Who would ever do that? But we don't really need that. If instead of having the 4096, we just have kind of a direct lookup, we still learn about the value, we just learn about a different part of the value. So we're getting information, we just need to do some bit shifting to like make use of that. So yes, it's harder than our contrived example, but the same principles apply. We just need to think different about, we're not gonna get the lower bits, which is definitely the most convenient, we're gonna get some of the middle bits, but that's still gonna be very useful, and we can still kind of read a lot of memory that way. We just have to like kind of start at a different place. So like, for example, if I want to read from address 1000, if I have something that uses an int for array 1 of x, I check a value that is, you know, I try to have it read from something just before that 10000 byte, So it's in the middle bits, because the index gives us the middle bits of the value being accessed. But then we have to have, still have, you know, so I've gotten rid of this contrived part, but we still have this contrived part. We have this double array access. Who would do a double array access? Surely that's rare. And the problem is, it's not. So here's a very sort of realistic looking system call. We take some argument and we look up an index, like a file descriptor, in a table. First we check if it's out of bounds of the table. Good idea. Just like our template code. Then we look up in the table, just like our array 1 of x access. Then we use that, depending on what kind of file descriptor it is, we have different operations to perform. Great. We're going to look that up in another table, like the array 2 of x access. And you might say, shouldn't we have a bounds check on kind? Doesn't matter. It can be mispredicted. And so you can see here that what looked like a contrived code pattern now is happening in this perfectly normal routine OS code. And this is why Spectre was a really big deal. It turned out when you look for these, what are sometimes called gadgets, that let us get information, that they were actually just naturally present everywhere. And we're going to need to spend extra effort to get rid of them. So that's where I'm going to finish up today. Next time we will go through some more examples of like figuring out cache indices based on evictions and finish up this side channel material. That's where I'll finish up.